is here from him and from our other panelists. And we're going to be talking about online engagement and technology. They're each going to share some information, and then we're going to have a kind of open conversation, and then we'll do Q&A as we did in the last panel. But I've asked Gary to start and give us a little context setting of kind of Gov 2.0 and all of the things that are kind of happening with technology.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. And I wanted to start by saying thank you very much to the organizers of this event and to all the sponsors and especially all the participants. I really learned a lot here by being here and some amazing stories in the audience. A lot of hard work that you've all done. So I want to say congratulations and thanks again for having us here. Just a little bit of background. You heard this morning from my colleague Sherry Greenberg. And Sherry and I are teaching graduate students at the LBJ School at UT about Gov 2.0 transparency, using new online tools for reaching out to citizens in new ways about what government is doing. I started this about 3 years ago at the request of former Senator Bill Bradley, who asked me to look into the concept of a new interactive federal budget. And so we had a year-long project with graduate students doing that. We sent a bunch of people back to the White House and worked with the transition team. We worked with the Office of Management and Budget on what eventually became the Open Government Initiative that was announced on the first day of President Obama's administration. And we continue to work with OMB and various other federal groups and groups across the nation on transparency issues. In the last year, we have switched that work to the state of Texas. And so we are now looking at transparency issues in Texas. And we're particularly focused right now on the next legislative session because the budget deficit of the state of Texas is getting wider and wider every day. And we think that this is going to be a historic session. So on January 28th and 29th, we're holding a statewide event on how citizens can follow and engage with the legislative session that will be starting up in January. So I encourage you to keep an eye out for that event because we're going to be talking about what citizens can do to stay engaged with their government. I'm going to make this really brief. I don't have any real prepared slides or anything like that, but I do want to make a few points. First, community engagement about government is going on, whether you like it or not, online. It's happening online. It's happening all over the internet. This is one of the new features that government officials have to take for granted, that people are going to be talking about what you do in various places. And in my experience, and I've watched these kinds of experiments all over the world, is that government doesn't manage these conversations very well. That is, the effort on the part of some governments to think of government 2.0 as bringing those kinds of conversations into official government activities is, we don't have a very good track record on that. It doesn't work very well. Most government officials don't know how to do this, and it often leads to a lot of bad experiences. You get people who get actually angrier with each other than they started off with, and you get public officials that are more alienated from the public, and the whole thing can just go terribly awry. The most common feature, of course, is that you try to launch some kind of public engagement process that the government wants to see happen and nobody responds. It's just, you know, dead air. And that makes the government look bad. It makes the government feel like they're not in touch with their citizens and everything else, even though this is the most common experience that public officials have. So my main message is, one of the slides was up there, that I think that the really value-added thing that governments can do for citizens is to enable them to have these conversations and to do it in a way that is better informed, more effective, more rich in terms of its results for using things like metadata hashtags that we were talking about this morning, all of those kinds of things that people are using today, geographic information for maps, all kinds of things that are now kind of standard ways of doing things on the internet that the government can enter into and help citizens foster these kinds of conversations so that there's an engenderment of trust between government institutions and citizens using these new tools. And I'll just conclude by saying that if you really want to see it done well, do what Boehner is doing. Because Phil and Dustin Heisler have been doing just absolutely amazing things. They're getting attention from all over the world, even from the White House, from Stanford University, from the city of Moscow, from Italy, Japan. It's just amazing what Boehner, Austin, city of Austin, just not Austin, okay. No, we're paying attention. We're paying attention. The White House was just there a few weeks ago. So you guys have been doing some really, really fantastic stuff.
Well, now there's a segue for you. So why don't you share a little bit about what you have with UniMaine?
It kind of started out, Dustin Heisler, who is our assistant city manager, we brought him in as finance officer and we're working, and we really had to get our original operating platforms underway. They were operating on four different platforms, one for court, one for police, one for accounting and payroll, but none of these communicated with each other, and one of them turned out to be nothing more than a spreadsheet that we were paying $4,000 a year for the privilege of using. It took us about a year and a half, and we were searching for a way to handle our filing systems. And Dustin came, located, and found multi-level barcode. And if you've seen them, they look like the pictures you stare at forever, and you finally see a picture. But what you do is you read these things with your cell phone, and then you can actually embed the information in the barcode itself, or you can embed a URL which takes you to a website. And that's what we decided to use them for. As we experimented around, we placed them throughout our community on historic locations and on locations where we wanted to give people information, like on a new structure, like a water tank or something of that nature. We have, for instance, an old home that was built in 1897. And if you click your cell phone, use your cell phone and effectively read your barcode through your cell phone, It'll show you a picture of the house under construction and tell you who built it and that type of information. And our one tourist attraction in Maynard is the old water tank where Leonardo DiCaprio climbed in the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Great. Actually, though, the truth is, part of the time you see that, and part of the time that water tank's over in Pflugerville, but what he climbed is in Maynard. And if you click on the sign, it will show him climbing the water tank and give you information actually about when the water tank was built and what it cost. And from that, the international reputation just kind of hit us, and it really slapped us in the face. We had no knowledge that it was going to do anything like that. We were just hoping for a little recognition. From that, we have implemented just a host of programs, and we're now working with 26 separate entities. You mentioned a few: Stanford University, University of Trento, Italy, and they're taking the University of Trento, Italy is taking the QR codes and have made them into tags for your pet tags, where if the police read them with their cell phone, they can tell the name of the dog, who the owner is, when he's last vaccinated, and we'll be going to Italy hopefully in the next few weeks to finish that project with them. From that, Dustin has done most of the work with this. I told her, if any of you ask me what kind of computers we have, I'm going to say black. But nonetheless, he found he's been working with Spigot out of California, and we've implemented an innovations platform in which anybody in the world can submit an idea to the city of Maynard for improving the town or anything around us. We've had over 80 participants in that thing from really around the world. We've implemented five of those deals, but it's not just an electronic suggestion box. It has a process that works through, and each suggestion has to go from a suggestion all the way through the implementation stage, a four-step process, and it has enough buzz on the internet and on the are out there for people to look at before we will even consider it. And the way we keep that buzz up is what we call InnoBuzz, and it encourages the participation, the continued participation of people in that process. And InnoBuzz, you earn a buck for doing certain things with the program, and you can trade those InnoBuzz in. You know, restaurants have given free meals and that type of thing, but you can also be named mayor for the day, or we'll name a week for you, or you can ride with the chief of police. And surprisingly, in Japan and China and those places, being named mayor for a day is a big deal, and they participate heavily. The other thing we found is that our own employees, the ones that if you lined our employees up and you picked the three that would suggest the link that you think would not suggest anything, they've each made a suggestion, two of which are near implementation, and the third is under consideration. And that surprised us more than any different deal. From there, we've gone on to we're working with C-Click Fix. Have y'all discussed C-Click Fix? It's based on your cell phone. If you're in it's particularly good in a larger community. If you see a pothole or a problem, you can hold your cell phone up, take a picture of it, transmit it immediately to our street department, and it goes directly through us to our street personnel so that they know the pothole is there. And maybe we don't have problems when potholes are there. You can just drive down the street. But what it does do is, in the eastern part of Travis County, we have the Blackland Prairies, and the soil moves dramatically. And there will be times when a manhole will move as much as a foot on our streets. And overnight, we will know immediately that we have a problem there and can go fix it rather than having to drive the streets every time there's rain and see what's going on. It's been a tremendous thing. But we have a whole bunch more of these going, and it's a daily learning process. And one of our philosophies is also, if it costs money, we don't do it. And that's not a joke. The mayor has a budget on its operating budget for its technology of about $100,000. And 90% of that money goes to pay for those four basic operating systems, which you have to buy. That leaves us very little to do the other things. So we work with people who are willing to use us as a beta test site and to experiment and see if their software is really going to work and see if it will do the job that they think it's going to do. And in return, we tell them what we found and how it does and doesn't work. And finally, he mentioned we had a convention about a month ago in which the White House came down and participated in NASA, just a group from all around the country and around the world, and tremendous input from them. And we took another city in North Texas called Dillon, and we put the 2,500 people, no tax base, even less than they had, and we implemented everything that we've got over to them and duplicated it, including the QR codes. In fact, they have more QR codes in their town than we have in ours now. They have like 40 of them, I believe, that you can go see. And everything we did was duplicated for them, and the total cost of it, other than the one we printed the signs for the QR code, was $38 a month. So it can be done. It can be done on the cheap, but you got to be dedicated to doing it, and you got to be willing to look at it every day. When is ATB coming? So we just kind of suspended it.
So I'm gonna. I actually brought a few slides. It's not really long. Just a quick overview. So I'm going to be talking about specifically about public participation, how you can use the internet to support problem solving and decision making with your communities, with your citizens. And my key takeaways right at the beginning here is that there's a lot of opportunity in using the internet. We heard some examples here already, and I believe it's a great way to deepen and broaden civic engagement and specifically public participation. And it was nice to hear that Will said, you can actually do this, and please do, and get creative play with these new tools, and then share what you learn. I think that's a key role learning. It's still a very young discipline, and we're eager to hear from you. Some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that we often hear about when it comes to decision-making are on the list. Some were brought up in the marketplace discussions as well. I think one of the biggest benefits in using online tools is that you can actually broaden your reach. You can bring people who cannot attend your face-to-face meetings, and if you have large geographic distances, you can bring in those people as well. It's not meant to be a replacement for face-to-face or for existing stuff, but I think it can be a good complement. The verdict is still out in terms of cost. I think depending on what you do, it can be a big cost saver. You can actually leverage, as on a whole, you can leverage your existing resources. For some things, it may actually be very, very expensive to do and very resource intensive. I'm just going to go through four examples, and I tried to pick a few that just tickle your mind a little bit and see what's out there. There's a lot more. I'm going to talk about very basic just public information programming in Portland using Facebook, a project in Biloxi that involved citizens in mapping assets locally, something about broken budgets. You may have heard there's cities that don't have a lot of money. And they're trying to get input from their citizens as to how they should address these difficult decisions. And then finally, a very interesting use case is to hold contests where you invite citizens to solve a particular problem, either build an application or come up with an algorithm. So if you go to this first slide here, very simple standard Facebook page. If you're familiar with Facebook, this is a public planning or urban planning project in Portland, very long-term, several years. And they use Facebook very effectively to keep people up to date, to share information that's relevant to the project. And of course, they can make use of all the benefits that come with being on a social network like Facebook. Next one. This is a tool built on free or freely available tools, Google Maps and Drupal. And they were talking about how to develop after-school programs. And during those discussions, they thought they should maybe assess all the resources that they have available in their city. So they had someone develop this tool where you could go zoom into the map and then locate an asset that you thought was relevant to the discussion. And I've, I think we're going to share the slides. You have the URLs in those slides, and you can actually surf and follow up. You can have it right now, right? This next one here is a pretty standard brainstorming, or sometimes called crowdstorming site. There are many applications. Spigot also has similar features where people can submit ideas and then others can give input on those ideas and express whether they think they're good ideas or not. The key, of course, always is to know how that is going to feed into the decision-making process. If it's done well, then this is actually being listened to and you actually state at the very beginning what you can do with that input. If it's done not so well, then citizens get very excited and they give a lot of input, and then they find out that the decision was already made and it's all in vain. So that's not good quality consultation. And then finally, last year, very interesting, I know redistricting has been an issue in Texas also. In Ohio, they were looking at redistricting and invited citizens to come up with their own algorithms using various mapping tools. And they gave the boundaries, they gave the rules. There are certain conditions that have to be met. They have to be like similar size, and they have to be close to each other, and a list of things that you can actually measure. And then they had about, I think, 30 or 3 dozen or so entries. And the interesting thing is that you could create a lot of awareness about this issue and how that there are different trade-offs in deciding how to cut the map into small pieces. As far as I know, they got a lot of insights from looking at these different results here. Okay, next one. Yeah, there's a gazillion tools. And in preparation for this panel, I was asked to maybe come up with a nice little map, like which tool fits for what process or outcome. And it's often very hard to do, because a lot of these tools are very, especially the generic social media tools, can be applied to a variety of processes and a variety of use cases. So it always kind of depends. My current working guideline is that if you know what you're doing, if you know what your objective is, a simple tool can go a long way, but a more sophisticated tool is not going to save you if you don't have your process in place. So you can have a very fun brainstorming tool, but as I said, if it's not embedded into the actual decision-making process, it's not going to be a lot of value. That's fine. Well, the web is different than a lot of the traditional channels in the face-to-face events that you may do. You may have to think about accessibility and data security and privacy and how you handle identity and whether you need to archive the online discussions that you're holding and whether there are legal requirements. Is your public elected official allowed to participate on Facebook or not? Can he or she blog? There are a lot of issues, and they're all trade-offs. And there's no silver bullet, this is how you should do it. It always depends on what you're trying to achieve and who you're working with and what your personal preferences are in some cases. Online participation, to me, is really a combination of, yes, technology, but also good process and people. And technology alone and tools alone are not going to get you all the way. Specifically with regard to public participation, always be clear about your commitments. So how much impact will the participants' input and their ideas have on the actual decision? That's where we see the most mistakes being made. I was talking earlier about an example where the new government in the UK just when they came out with their coalition contract or coalition agreement, they posted that online, and they thought they were doing a great service, and shared that information in a timely manner and allowed people to comment. And in the end, it turned out the public was very disappointed because they expected that they would have an impact on an improved version of the document, when in fact it was a final document. Mismatched expectations. A few resources and slides, and that's pretty much it.
Bring me back full circle to your point about how they don't know how to manage. So the governments are struggling with how to manage the amount of input that's coming in. They launch these processes because they seem cool. So if you're maybe want you to reflect a little bit more, because really for me, a lot of my questions are around the pitfalls. The technology seems like, oh, it's great, and we can use this, and then folks start to try to launch it, and that doesn't go real well, and creates more of that cynicism that you mentioned. So say more about that issue.
Now, of course, we have to remember these are really, a lot of these are just really new tools, and even the people who are experienced using them are still trying to figure some of them out. And also, they're constantly morphing, changing, especially Facebook. One of the things that I think that people inside the public sector should think about is how to bring this paradigm inside their own organizations so that they're practicing sort of collaboration on these platforms inside the organization so that you build capacity among your own employees to figure out what works and what doesn't. Now, let me give you a couple of examples. The United States State Department has launched a wiki called Diplopedia, which is pretty much like Wikipedia, except it's used by foreign service officers all over the world. And it's open like Wikipedia for editing, except in this case, the editing is only done by foreign service officers. So when somebody changes a duty station, say they go from the Ivory Coast to Mali or something like that, they get there and they can look this up on Diplopedia and find out all this information that the last person there left
toward, because I was talking to Dustin a little bit about this, too, about how it's a shift from the public managers thinking that it's something that more that they have to do, and how are they going to integrate it into their systems and their decision-making, and how are we going to deal with all this input that we're asking for. And it seems like Banner's done a pretty good job of that, so I'm curious about how you kind of made that organizational mindset shift to really start saying, yes, this is an asset for us.
I didn't give them a choice. Actually, it evolves as people begin to realize that it's not creating more work. In a lot of ways, it's creating less work. And people have more time to do everything else. They're not taking the telephone calls that they used to take with people driving about things. And it's out there a lot more. And we've seen a real shift within our employee base in support of these things. It used to be a running joke that, okay, Dustin's got another idea for me. And now it's, okay, Dustin's got another idea. And as you can see, we were really dependent on him. But the employee base went right along with it very well. And as they become more educated in it, the more the easier it becomes for everybody else. And all hopefully. And the new employees that come in are immediately into it. And it's kind of shut down their throats, and they just go on the floor.
So then I put my citizen hat on, and I think, Twitter and Facebook and getting emails about stuff, and I kind of tune that stuff out. I get overloaded as a citizen trying to understand all that information. So I'm curious about how we can really, not do that information overload where it's kind of too much. I'm interested in how stuff stays relevant for citizens and how it's not so much just an inundation of new tools and a push out of information, but how it really is interactive, how we're really engaging folks.
Well, part of that is that those who choose to go on Facebook and all can. Those who choose, we try to also put it in the newspaper, the same information in the newspaper. We also try to have it available with our employees so that people call in and stuff. So we don't really shove it down their throats as a citizen, but and also everything, of course, is because it's on Facebook and the other social medias. We have it on our websites. So you have four different ways, and if they're interested, they can find a way to interact with it. And slowly but surely, the Facebooks and the Twitters and all are growing and growing. One or two a week, and we're up in, I don't know what the numbers are, but we're all up there in several hundreds of people monitoring us on a weekly and on a daily basis.
I was going to add that I think public officials beat themselves up a lot unnecessarily about levels of participation. We just had an election where the percentage of people that voted was pretty low, and when you roll out some kind of participatory thing online and you get, just a handful of people participating, then I've seen over and over again government officials kind of wring their hands and bang their heads against the wall. Why isn't this working? Well, it's just new for a lot of people. It's not part of their normal practice. They've got busy lives, as many people have mentioned here. This is happening all over the world. It's not just you. And so if you think, that you're not reaching 40 or 50% of your population or something like that with some idea that you've got, it's not unusual. And you should take that into consideration when you're thinking about what the benchmarks are for civic participation, whether it's face-to-face or using these new tools.
I think with in terms of participation rates, the successful examples that I'm aware of, they either had existing relationships, so they didn't start from scratch. They had already done, had been busy building a culture where they were in touch on these social networks or other traditional channels. They also spend a lot of their budget on marketing, getting the word out. And they also plan it so that it's not an overnight, hey, we're going to do participation tomorrow. It's actually announced early and repeatedly. And finally, I would say the more successful examples also integrate well on and offline. So it's actually a cohesion of, we're going to have these meetings and these events in the neighborhoods. I'm thinking about a project in Germany about, again, budgets, but they had a very closely tied together, the online portion and the face-to-face portion. It was all ending in one, recommendation at the end.
I read my mind, because then I was going to put my practitioner hat on, and then a poll response where folks were surprised that answer about blending online and face-to-face was a big question for folks here. It's a big question for me, because I tend to be a little, not technophobic, but I don't realize, I know that stuff's out there, but it's like, ooh, but I want to do this other stuff that, I'm more familiar with. And so I'm curious about any stories, any examples, and you might have some other places, too, where there were principles to consider, like what should folks in the room be thinking about as they're trying to blend these pieces together and how to leverage the online stuff, but also have it fit well in with the face-to-face, the more traditional engagement that they're doing in their normal work.
We're seeing different approaches. You can just have them run in parallel, pretty much not connected. You just know they reach different audiences with different channels. But you can use both to drive participation to the other, right? You can promote your face-to-face events with the online and vice versa. We've also seen examples where you can use the online to leading up to an event or the follow-up to capture the energy out of the face-to-face and then try to continue the work online. So there's different approaches how to do that. And the combination can be more loose or pretty tight. I think what should be clear is, in the way you communicate these projects, is that they are, that you're doing both, that they're not completely random.
Now, this research shows that people who worry about things like Facebook and texting and Twitter and so on, replacing face-to-face interaction are just wrong. The data just doesn't support it. That in fact, these things are actually increasing social interaction. And a lot of people are finding out about the things that they can be involved with in face-to-face through these mediums. And I was skeptical about Twitter for a while until I organized an international school at the University of Porto in Portugal. And we probably had the highest density of Twitterers of any place on Earth while we were doing this school. But we advertised a hashtag for the school, and we generated a conversation about what we were doing face-to-face that included people all over the world in real time. And we were getting into it from those people who were following what we were talking about all over the world. So what has happened is essentially face-to-face meetings like this have now been extended into space. So we're having a conversation with people who are not here. And this is a new feature of face-to-face meetings that actually enriches the face-to-face meeting. It doesn't substitute for it, it doesn't replace it. It just extends it out into space.
So let me ask you before, I'm going to open it up for questions, because I'm sure folks have a variety of questions that I'm not thinking of, but I am curious about kind of what is the one big issue or question that you're grappling with as you see kind of this online engagement unfolding. What is something that's on the horizon that makes you stop and think, wow, that's going to be interesting to deal with, or that's something I'm really curious to see how it unfolds, or I'm just kind of wanting to know the big question out there in your own mind about online engagement. So who wants to start?
Is for the public sector to start putting out information in ways that can be used by people who know how to program computers. And right now, the sort of transition period that we've been in the public sector is to put stuff online in PDF documents. These are essentially electronic versions of the same old stuff that we've been producing for a couple of hundred years. And we think that that's a transitional phase, that eventually there's not going to be
good thing in Maynard.
Growth, we hope.
H-U-B.
Actually, at this particular point, we don't have a specific plan. We're kind of like he just explained. We're trying to catch up with. In fact, this morning I spent 4 hours trying to get PDF documents online. You can read it tonight. But that's really an important thing because we're constantly being asked for information that we have in paper form, that in file cabinet after file cabinet, and we're trying to get it up there where if we can get those people to look at it on an online version, it would save an enormous amount of time and educate people better. I guess the biggest single problem we have in Maynard is that we have a lot of people coming out, moving out from Austin, and they want to see what Austin delivers. They don't want to see what Maynard's capable of delivering. They think if Austin's got it and I move to Maynard, therefore I should have it. But don't touch me. I think that's going to be our biggest challenge over the next 5 or 10 years is how to meet the needs of the Austinites coming to Maynard that expect technology far beyond what a small community of Maynard, Georgetown, they'll get in grid that the name of Maynard, every one of them is going to be able to deliver.
But the people in Italy think that Maynard's in Silicon Valley.
They don't. They came over and saw it.
So the main challenge that my company is working on is how to support good, authentic process on the web. I think there's a rich body of knowledge in face-to-face interactions and group process and facilitation and good public participation. And a lot of the tools that we see today are still fairly limited in supporting some of these more advanced processes. And in most cases, it's not the tools' fault because they were never designed to support this kind of very structured thing in the first place. The Facebook was not designed with the intent of supporting public participation. But I think that's going to be our biggest challenge and endeavor to support that process.
Sophistication of the tools and the ability for
the tools and also it's a combination. There's certain pieces that I think the technology is very good at, and greatly surpasses any face-to-face setting. And then there are other pieces that, frankly, people are much better at asking the right questions and knowing when to slow down and take detours. Still not really easily automated.
I think one of those responses in the poll was about how it's just not the same as that human interaction, right? Building that trust and looking someone in the eye, actually knowing what was going on in that conversation. So, that'll be interesting to see how that emerges. So let's open it up for questions. Hopefully we've got some around the room. I think we've got some volunteers with mics. I'd be curious what kind of questions folks have.
Is the fact that everything we do online, whether it be through Facebook, Twitter, or any ancillary work through our website is public record. And I have a real problem with that because of the fact that, you get information coming in as well as going out. And sometimes the stuff we get, even though we have a spam system, can be pretty scary too. So how do you work within the system to really protect both yourself and the public so that we don't run into problems down the road? Because we have a system where everything is duplicated, whether our information is coming in, it's held in our server, and any response is also held in the server.
Each public agency has its own policies with respect to these kinds of things about what they do or what they can do or things like that. But in general, I think that the public has come to understand that even from their own experiences using their own email accounts and things like that, they get a lot of stuff that they don't want, and they get a lot of stuff that they find otherwise sort of offensive or troublesome or stuff like that, and that no one is protected from this. There's no silver bullet for that. And so there's a kind of general feeling, I think, that we're all in the same boat, and therefore we just have to have a kind of capacity for understanding that those things, if they're saved as public records, are going to contain that kind of information. That's the best I can say.
We're just talking about that yesterday. I think in some cases the regulations and the laws have not caught up with how these tools have evolved. So it's probably a good idea to be on good terms with your legal department and stepping too far ahead. But we're seeing, we're having a discussion, someone's having a discussion about the Brown Act and how that affects blogging. And there's different schools of thought. I mean, some people actually think elected officials should definitely participate and it is covered, and some are much more conservative and so.
Yeah, be cautious about the legal aspect of this, because lawyers are trying to say no. And in many cases, you know, public officials don't want to answer in front of lawyers, because then they've been legally advised. And you know, we're in this kind of, this existed before these tools came along. You know, it existed in the issue about email and stuff like that. So this is not a new thing. We're just in this kind of way of groping our way through this. People worry about it a lot. So far, there are not any catastrophic kinds of examples of something horrible that's happened because of using Facebook or Twitter.
Well, I was going to put it a little more bluntly than Gary did. If you don't ask your lawyer, you're still can't pay you. But down the road for somebody who may want budget information or whatever, we obviously can't get everything out of it. We try. Our philosophy has become, the more we put out there, it's just less headaches and less work for us now. But how do you assure, as these government processes become more and more prevalent, that there's equitable access? I work in a public library. Public libraries are great for providing public internet access, but it's just not adequate. There are many long lines, long waits for computers. How do you in government then provide that equitable access?
I don't think it really matters whether they have computer access or not. Let me give you an example. We have our bulk trash day. We put it six times in the newspaper, six consecutive weeks. It was in the American Statesman. We put brochures out all over town. We hung signs up around town. We put it on the internet. We put it on Twitter. We put it on Facebook. We put it in their utility bills. So the very first call we get on Monday is, why didn't you tell us? So access
is like graduate students.
Yeah. So access is there. It's just hard. People don't have the time, and they're in so many activities that they don't always utilize the access. So.
Yeah, I would think about it in a little bit different way, and that is that public sector information and participation can be a demand driver for computer access. And this is a good, I've been involved with the Texas State Library over assessing public access to computers through public libraries. And we've seen use of public access computers go way up. It appears to be countercyclical in the economy. When the economy is bad, then people are using public access computers, which is bad for libraries because their revenues are going down at the same time that the demand is going up. So I think what needs to happen is for libraries to be better at explaining this to public officials, that there is this countercyclical tendency that they need more attention to public access, and that to deal with the digital divide, public sector participation and information can be a demand driver for increasing people's skills and access.
I would just say that it's a very important issue, of course. I wouldn't let that stop me from experimenting and starting to use the tools where they make sense. If you look at how access has increased by and large over the last 2, 5, 10 years, and how that trend continues, I think 5 years from now we're going to have more people with access. But we haven't solved it this week or next.
By the way, one thing that's really changed over the last few years, which is better for access, is that most of the stuff that is available for accessing information now is free. So you don't have to have bought expensive software packages and things like that the way you used to have to.
I want to thank our panel. Thank you all very much.